It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says that universities need diverse faculty and not just a diverse student body.
But first, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Two trains derailed early in the week in Alma and Watertown, and state lawmakers have introduced legislation designed to make rail transportation safer.
And there were a couple major business stories in the state this week featuring Roundy's, Pick and Save, and Miller.
Here to talk about those stories is Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So earlier in the week, as we said, two trains derailed in Wisconsin, one carrying ethanol and the other carrying crude oil. What more do we know about those incidents now?
Yes, so both were major events, and then actually there was a much smaller scale and not serious derailment that happened on Wednesday as these others were being investigated. So on the Watertown crash, a Canadian Pacific train carrying crude oil, largely from back in oil fields, derailed. There were 13 cars that were off the track, and they lost 1,000 gallons of crude oil. 35 homes were evacuated in the area, so it was a big deal. As far as we know now, the oil did not reach any waterways, and the railroad is going to be doing soil remediation in the area. And that happened only one day after this big derailment in Alma spilled thousands of gallons of ethanol into the Mississippi River. So it coming at the same time, it certainly raises questions that have been in the air already about sort of rail safety and whether there are protections for residents in these areas.
Well, and especially coming right on the heels of the Obama administration rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline, people are saying, you know, these materials are going to get moved one way or another, and if they're not going through pipelines, they're going to be on trains. So it really brings it into sharp relief in that sense. In response to the derailments, a Democratic state lawmaker is coming up with some safety reforms. What would those do?
So one of the things, Representative Jill Billings of La Crosse said that she's circulating a bill that would fund more rail inspectors, also more training for first responders, and maybe most significantly would require railroads to submit their emergency prevention and response plans. So the issue is, we've seen this. This is what you say is absolutely right. The growth of rail traffic in Wisconsin and really everywhere has been tremendous as a result of largely a lot of this back in oil. But what happens is the rail company, railroads travel on private land. They're private companies, and a lot of cases there's no requirement on them to even say what is in the trains. And so in many cases, first responders don't know how to respond because they don't know what they're always responding to.
So Gannett, Wisconsin Media actually did an investigative report on this topic over the summer, looking at the impact that increased rail traffic has on the lives of people around the state of Wisconsin. What did you find?
Yeah, this was a really fascinating project, and what we looked at, we started from a specific issue of stopped trains in rural Wisconsin. Central Wisconsin is where we were looking, and there were cases where, because of the increased rail traffic, it's gridlock on the rail lines, and so there were stopped trains blocking people's access to their homes for 8 hours, 10 hours. There were cases of people who had to climb in between these trains that are stopped on the track, which is fine unless one of those trains then suddenly starts moving, and then it could be a real safety hazard. And we found this is a statewide issue, almost a nationwide issue, and it really is the case. I'll say in numbers. For instance, crude oil alone, nationally there were 30,000 carloads of crude oil transported in 2010, and by 2014 it was nearly 500,000 carloads. So there's no comparison. The increase in traffic.
We're talking with Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett Central Wisconsin Media. It's our Wisconsin News Roundup. Now, Rob, let's turn our attention to some business news. First, we found out that Kroger will buy Milwaukee-based Roundy's Incorporated. What do we know about the details of that purchase?
Yeah, so Kroger is based in Cincinnati, giant grocery store chain, and is buying Roundy's for $800 million. Roundy's, of course, is the parent company of Pick and Save and Cops grocery stores, which are all over Wisconsin. But it's been struggling. Roundy's was carrying almost $650 million in debt, and so they were in a position where it was hard for them to expand or to upgrade existing stores. Kroger is, first of all, it's a much bigger company. It's a $108 billion per year company, and it's been growing. And so there's an expectation that that with the purchase, they might be able to. We might eventually see some upgrades to these Wisconsin stores.
And is there any word whether there will be closings of Wisconsin's Roundy's stores or like Pick and Save or Cops?
So Kroger is bullish right now. They've added 25,000 jobs last year. They added 20,000 jobs the year before that. Of course, it's a giant sort of national company or multi-state company. But they see this as a growth move. One thing that's interesting in the sort of world of grocery retailers is the largest competition is not just from other grocers, but they're increasingly seeing big competition from big superstores like a Walmart or a Target that compete with standalone grocery stores.
So moving from food to drink, Miller Brewing Company was in the news as well this week. The merger between the parent companies of Miller and Budweiser appears to be moving forward. What does that mean for the state?
Yeah, this is going to be it's going to be the largest beer company known to man, Anheuser-Busch InBev, which is now based in Belgium, is already the world's largest beer company, and it's buying up SAB Miller, the Milwaukee company, which is like a top competitor, and so it's going to be a giant behemoth. They sort of finalized the terms. They're going to buy for $107 billion, and it's absolute shockwaves that there is a concern about. Competitors are concerned about it. I've even seen somebody saying that they're going to be big enough to be able to corner the market on hops and other beer ingredients.
So, are there concerns? Will this possibly be blocked because it would create such a monopoly?
I mean, it seems like a big deal to me. Often these things go through, but there are regulatory hurdles, and I think that we could expect to see, especially among other beverage makers, a hearty argument that this company would be too big.
Well, and we'll have to see if Miller fans and Bud fans are able to become friends after after so long being rivals.
Sure. Sure.
Well, finally, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is in the news again as lawmakers are talking about reforms to that troubled agency, or what they characterize as a troubled agency. Why has Assembly Leader Robin Voss said he'd be open to changes?
Yeah, so it's a bit unclear what exactly that means, open to changes, but it's a far cry from actually committing to any changes. But it is something. He was quoted saying that I almost think that the agency is so tarnished that we need to figure out a new model to fix it in order to do it. So sounding like he might be open to more than just cosmetic changes, which of course is what Democrats have been calling for years.
Well, and at the federal level, Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin has called for a federal investigation into loans made by WEDEC. What do we know about that, and is she looking particularly at some loans more than others?
Yeah, so she has singled out a handful of loans that the agency made, and of course, I think everyone agrees that the loans were not well administered, and in many cases, it's been a mess. I think everyone sort of agrees that there are a lot of loans in default. There were a lot of cases where the state didn't follow up on loans. One of the interesting ones that Senator Baldwin singles out in her request is for a loan to a guy named William Minahan of a company named Building Committee, Inc., that was a top Governor Walker donor. And that company got $500,000 from the state. It was, and some people in the administration pushed for up to $4 million, and they got that even after the state learned that he had been telling his creditors, Minahan, that he would use state funds to pay off debt on leases of luxury cars like Maseratis. So it's a sign that maybe not a guy that should have got a loan.
So just to wrap up, Rob, a couple of bills signed by Governor Walker this week, concealed carry and an upskirting bill. First of all, explain what the upskirting bill is.
Yeah, so this makes a felony this practice of surreptitiously taking photographs of women's skirts, which is disgusting and assault. And I think it's nice that it's going to be a felony if that is ultimately passed. But this is there are websites that focus on this, so that would at least sort of crack down on that.
Well, Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That was editor Robert Menser helping us recap the biggest headlines around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
At universities today, there's a lot of emphasis placed on recruiting and retaining a diverse student body. At the same time, new numbers show that, in large part, faculty diversity has not increased in the last couple of decades, especially for African Americans and Native Americans.
Our next guest took a look at the issue of faculty diversity for a recent article in The Atlantic called The Need for More Professors of Color. Autumn Arnett is a senior writer for Diverse Issues in Higher Education. Autumn, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write that back in the 90s, there was a move for universities to make more diverse faculty and administrative hires. So where did that push come from?
I think that it came from an overall push across the country for affirmative action efforts. So at the same time, we had a number of lawsuits, Adams and Ayers, that were pushing for increased opportunities for Black students. And I think that there was a recognition then that you couldn't recruit more Black students without also making an effort to have faculty that looked like them on campus.
So a couple decades later, where is that effort?
A couple decades later, we're actually regressing a bit. And I think that's for a number of reasons. I think that affirmative action has become increasingly more controversial. So in the 90s, it was pretty commonly accepted that affirmative action was a necessary means to achieve some equity in the higher education and really in multiple landscapes. And now we see that coming under attack. The Supreme Court is gearing up to hear the Fisher versus University of Texas case again. And we're also seeing, though, which is not necessarily a negative, a change in the cultural landscape of the country. So in the 90s, we still very much saw the country as Black and white in a number of respects, again. But by the time we get to 2015, we are realizing that there are so many more ethnicities and so many more people that we need to recognize in addition to African-American and Caucasian professors and students and people in general.
You said that a couple decades later from the affirmative action of the 90s that we're regressing. So in terms of where we are, is that true across all ethnicities that there's been regression or some different?
So there's been an increase for Asian Americans, and Native Americans have remained pretty constant, but their share is less than 1% of the population. So a constant when you're at less than 1% is still not really a good trend. But for African Americans and Latinos, we've seen some downtrends in the faculty numbers across the board.
And you talk to experts looking at the issue of minority representation at universities. What did they tell you about why there wasn't more movement for African Americans and other minority groups?
I think there are two different schools of conversation. There's one that says, small university X in small town America might have a hard time attracting anyone to come to a town without many amenities. I tend to think that that's a lazy narrative. I think that there are things, and my article that you referenced mentioned some of the things that Dr. Jackson, Gerlando Jackson, who's based out of the University of Wisconsin, actually, that he suggested, including some additional faculty perks. So that would be things like offering additional conference stipends, having campus affinity groups, but if your numbers on campus aren't high enough, making sure that you provide ample time and resources for your faculty of color to go seek community at other in other spaces. There's another narrative, though, that says that some universities are understanding that they need to publicly say, you know, woe is us, what can we do? But behind closed doors, faculty and administrators of color, even though small in number, are making suggestions, and it's just not really a high priority to actually fix. So institutions are understanding, that it has to be part of the rhetoric, but when it comes time to actually act on some of these recommendations, that is a little slower in the making.
And another issue that came up was that university faculty of color sometimes got sidetracked from research, the things that would help them get promoted, because they tended to be given lots of other duties. How does that tend to play out?
So I don't know that it's officially university-imposed duties, right? But if you're one of maybe two black male faculty on an entire campus, for example, or one of two black female faculty, then you fall into this role of mentoring all of the minority students, of even when you're not necessarily having office hours, you have students hanging out in the office because the students are also looking for that sense of community on campus, and they see you as one of few people who look like them and may understand some of what they're going through. You take on some of the diversity work in terms of student group advising. So these are unofficial roles that the faculty are taking on. I don't mean to impose that the university is automatically saying, hey, you individual person of color in the department, you're going to be the person responsible for diversity. But you become a spokesperson for campus tours, for when reporters like myself come on campus, you become kind of the person who gets to get out front and talk about some of the diversity aims, and you just become the poster child by default because you're the only person there, if that makes sense.
Right. But you're right that, on the other hand, these faculty members wanted to take on some of these mentorship and other leadership roles because, you know, they liked it and they maybe felt a responsibility too.
Right. And I'm sorry, that's some of what I meant to get at, is that faculty feel a responsibility, a personal responsibility, to take on these students who are also trying to seek community.
We're talking.
So I didn't mean to suggest that it was university imposed.
Right. We're talking with Autumn Arnett right now, senior writer for Diverse Issues in Higher Education. She's talking about the need for faculty diversity at colleges and universities. And Autumn, there's a lot of attention now on how to recruit, how to retain a diverse student body, maybe less paid to faculty diversity. Do you think, first of all, that that's changing? And why do you think it is that there's been more emphasis on the student body?
I think it's, not to sound cynical, but the students pay tuition dollars. So you want to attract more students who will pay more money. I think there's also been, from the federal standpoint, more of a push for students, right? A lot of the lawsuits have been geared towards student access and opportunity. A lot of the activism on social media and otherwise has really been driven around students. I think particularly with the rise of social media, institutional reputation has become a big concern for a number of institutions. Students can complain about anything from, mold in the residence hall to the food that they don't like in the dining hall to racist incidents on campus. So when your students are your most outspoken constituents, I think they become the ones that you consider the most, and it helps that they are the ones who are paying the institution to be there and not the other way around.
And is there evidence that when there are students of color on campus, if they don't see professors there, as you said, that look like them, that they're maybe less likely to stay at that university or less likely to bring others on board?
I don't know if there's a direct one-to-one correlation, but certainly in some of the movements that we've seen this week across the country, at Yale, at the University of Missouri, we see that a big concern for the students of color is not seeing people who look like them represented in the faculty. So just for example, in New Haven, Connecticut, where Yale is located, the African-American population actually exceeds the white population. It's about 33% versus 32% in 2013. But at Yale, 72% of the students are white and fewer than 3% of the faculty are black. So for black students on campus, again, trying to find that sense of community, trying to find that sense of belonging, because in college between, you know, the ages of 18 and 22, when you're really trying to find yourself, feeling like you belong on campus is a big deal. And for a lot of the schools, they have significantly lower graduation rates and retention rates for the African-American students as compared to the population overall. And I think some of that may tie into this idea of not belonging on campus.
As you said, you talked with Professor Jackson from Wisconsin's Equity and Inclusion Lab, who said that there has to be a commitment to diversity from the entire institution. What would that look like?
So from the administrative level, it has to look like, A, creating spaces for your faculty, right, and creating some of these opportunities, allowing some time off, allowing some additional travel stipends so that they can attend conferences where they feel comfortable, where there are safe spaces, where they can just have conversations about things like frustrations about not wanting people to touch their hair, or just these very small cultural nuances that you don't think are important but that very much affect someone's psyche. So it's from the administrative level, it's providing more support, it's providing space for faculty affinity groups, it's having a real commitment to listening to faculty. If faculty bring issues, making them feel like they're issues and concerns are being heard and not just being brushed aside. At the departmental levels, it's making a commitment to really hire more diverse faculty members. It's making a commitment, again, to be supportive of those faculty members, to try to understand some of the needs for cultural space, some of the, even if it's just Lyceum events where you have discussions that are reflective of more cultures, to introduce the entire university, but really to provide some community for these faculty of color. It's going down to...
And we have to leave it there. Autumn, thank you so much for joining me. That was Autumn Arnett, senior writer for Diverse Issues in Higher Education. She joined us to talk about the need for faculty diversity at colleges and universities. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
November is Native American Heritage Month, and this year also marks the 80th birthday of one of Wisconsin's best Native American advocates.
Ada Deer is a member of the Menominee Tribe from Kenosha. She was the first member of the Menominee Nation to graduate from UW-Madison and the first Native American to earn a master's in social work from Columbia University.
Ada also became the first woman to chair the Menominee Nation in Wisconsin and then went on to head the United States Bureau of Indian Affairs under President Bill Clinton, as the first woman in that position as well. At 80, she is still deeply involved in Native American advocacy and activism. Ada Deer joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. And certainly anyone who has lived in Wisconsin for any length of time, I think, has heard about you and your work here in Wisconsin. But your history goes back so long. And you really credit Eleanor Roosevelt with helping to inspire you to grow into this activist role. When and how did you meet her?
I was a student here at the university, 1956, I was 21 years old. I was recruited to attend the Encampment for Citizenship, which is a leadership development program founded in 1946 by two civic-minded people, Al Black and Nanny Politzer. And the idea was, since many of the people there were fresh from Europe, the Holocaust was on people's minds, and some actually were survivors of the Holocaust. Never again. And so what do we do? Well, establish youth programs so that some of the youth of the world could be educated. So when I went, there were 100 college students from across the country, and we had workshops, we had field trips. It was in New York City at the Ethical Culture Society Fieldston School, which was located at the end of the subway line there at that time in New York. And we had workshops. I chose to attend the workshop on segregation and integration. And the reason I did that was I knew that I didn't know very much about Black history and culture and issues and so on, other than Blacks came, were brought here for slavery, and that they lots lived in the South, and they were being killed and oppressed there. So I thought this would be a good opportunity. And the reason I chose that was because I was here on this campus on May 17th, 1954, and my friend, who was the staff member of the then Governor's Commission on Human Rights told me that this is a very important day in the history of this country. And I said, well, why? She said that the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education had just outlawed segregation in the public schools. Mm. And I thought, wow, that sounded important. Mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand the whole thing then. And so then when I got to the encampment, I attended the workshop, which was then taught by what I say was a black school marm. You walked into her classroom, and boy, you better straighten up. No, she was firm, but and it was a workshop. We really did have speakers, and we made visits to all kinds of places in New York City. We went to the United Nations, and I turned on this fabulous sound system, and you could just turn the dial, you know, Russian, Chinese, you know, French, and I learned that, wow, all these universal languages there, and instantaneous translation. Mm-hmm. Well, at any rate, our school marm brought a black professor, Dr. Kenneth Clark, and his wife, Dr. Mamie Clark, in to talk to us. And he was making a presentation about the very famous doll experiment, as it was then known, and it still is. And it was a project where they took black dolls and white dolls and showed them to various black students in the South, as well as the ones in D.C., because this was in the early 50s, mm-hmm. and D.C. was still very segregated, and said to the little students, well, who would you like to play with? Who would you like to be friends with? Who's smart? A whole bunch of questions. And the little black kids mostly chose the whites. And Thurgood Marshall used this as a demonstration of the damage of racism in Brown versus Board of Education. And so I'm sitting there thinking, well, you know, someday I would like to do something of equal importance that affects Indians.
Right. And so at 21, here you are kind of being opened up to all of these issues of inequality and racism. What did you see as the greatest challenges for the Native American community back then in the 50s?
Well, I didn't see just one. There were many challenges. But let me finish answering your question. Then we visit the first question about Eleanor Roosevelt. Well, apartheid started in South Africa in 1948. This was 1956. And I knew that she was an important member of the United Nations and was involved in the Human Rights Commission. Someone recently told me that she was the chair of the commission. At any rate, she gave us a presentation. And it was wonderful going through, visiting the Roosevelt estate, and we had lunch on the lawn. Oh, it was so exciting. And then after she talked, she said, well, are there any questions? And I looked around because I'm a respectful person. Nobody was saying anything or raising their hand. So I thought to myself, well, this is the only time I'll ever have the opportunity to ask Eleanor Roosevelt a question. And so I asked her, Mrs. Roosevelt, I said, what about South Africa? They are killing their people. They're oppressing their people. And, you know, what should the UN do? Should they throw them out or what? And she looked at me, you know, kindly and gently and with great compassion and respect. And she said, well, you have to understand, change takes time. Violence is not the answer. Education is the way. Mm. And so Kenneth Clark and Eleanor Roosevelt deeply impressed me on very important issues. I was already on the help path due to my mother. She told me when I was under 10, Ada dear, you're an Indian and you were put on this planet for a purpose, and your responsibility is to help your people. And I said, well, okay, Mom. You know.
So what were some of those challenges that your people needed some leadership or support on?
Well, the eternal challenges of saving the land and saving the people. Indian people are still the poorest, by the census data, poorest people in the country. We have very high suicide rates, high poverty rates, high dropout rates. I get really tired of reciting these statistics. They're infuriating. Here we are in the richest country in the history of the world, and we have the first people here at the bottom of the barrel. I don't want to paint a completely negative picture, because Indians are such an important part mm-hmm. of our history, and we signed away millions of acres. My tribe, for example, 9.5 million acres of land, and we kept a small portion of that land as a reservation where we still live today. So the culture, the spirit, the love of the land, the respect for the land, these are all important to the environmentalists, but they really obtained these ideas mm-hmm. mostly from the American Indians. So now, today, people do not understand that they're not just the Indians. There are 560 tribes, over 560 federally recognized tribes. There are unrecognized tribes. There are state-recognized tribes. And there are various laws that, and policies that are the Indians are subjected to. We have the most laws of any group mm-hmm. in our country. And so self-governance is extremely important. I used to teach a course here at the university, and to try to answer your question in 1 minute is a daunting task. But land and people and culture, there were laws against the language, against the religion. People ask me, for example, well, do you speak your language? I said, well, no. And I said, well, my father was put in a Catholic boarding school. It happened to be Catholic on our reservation, but there were other schools. And the idea was to kill the Indian, save the man. Richard Pratt, a Civil War veteran, started the boarding schools in late 1800s. And he thought that they should really destroy the culture. That's what he meant. Mm-hmm. And make everybody white. Well, at any rate, we had the boarding school. So my father spoke the language very well. He was put in there when he was 10 because his mother died during the flu pandemic of 1918. And I wanted to learn it, but he said, no. He said, I was a girl. I wanted to go fishing with him. No, you're a girl. No. I wanted to go hunting. No, you're a girl. Well, of course, I didn't melt. As you can tell, I have a very forceful personality, even when I was a little kid. Well, he's my father. I really would like to do this. But if he doesn't want to do it, well, okay. You know, I'll figure it out.
Well, and let me jump in, Ada, and to let people know, we're talking with Ada Deer. She's celebrating her 80th birthday this year, and it's Native American Heritage Month. You weren't allowed to do a lot of things because you were a girl, but yet you were the first woman and the first Native American to do so many things. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
Well, let me say I've got my love and strength and inspiration from my mother. And she always supported me. And I have always been a questioning kid. And she answered my questions, and she told me I was an Indian, and she really strengthened that feeling of identity. I went, and I was the oldest of five. I have two brothers, two sisters, and trying to get this all in is really mm-hmm. difficult. But she told me, and I would pass this on to everybody, Ada Deer, be yourself. And because I didn't really understand this whole thing about teenage groups and all this stuff, because I never felt that I had to be part of a group and then and have this group think and all this stuff. So I'm kind of the lone ranger out there in my work and in my life. But that's okay. That's okay. I like myself. I know who I am. And I want everyone out there to look at themselves and figure out who they are and proceed on those paths. Everyone has strengths. Everybody has abilities. They have talents. But you have to work to develop them. And here I am talking with you as a proud graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I'm very open to new people and new ideas, and it's exciting to speak up and speak out and move the society along.
Well, I can't imagine a better place to leave it with those inspirational words. Ada Deer, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'll be happy to return another time.
After another 80 years, maybe before. We'd love to have you back. That was Ada Deer, Menominee advocate, social worker, and the former head of the United States Bureau of Indian Affairs, talking about her experiences as an advocate for civil rights and equality.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Reports are coming in about bombings and hostages being taken in Paris. We are going to go to NPR correspondent Eleanor Beardsley, who is on the ground in Paris, in just a moment. So we have Eleanor on the phone. Eleanor, what are you hearing?
Well, it's absolute chaos. The last time the prefecture of police confirmed was 18 dead, but now they're reporting much higher, at least 33, and we're hearing up to 60 dead. The police are telling people to go back inside, do not come out. There were three separate shootouts in the city of Paris and explosions at the National Stadium where two suicide bombers set themselves off. The stadium is being evacuated. The city is in lockdown. This is bringing back just the horrible memories of January. People are not going out. All of the restaurants have emptied out. It was a warm, fall night. People were out, unseasonably warm, and they're talking about now 60 people dead on a coordinated attack in Paris. The president, the prime minister, and the interior minister are in a crisis meeting. And this is another major attack on Paris, much worse than the one in January.
Yeah, I was just going to say, certainly the Charlie Hebdo attacks were significant, but it sounds like the number of venues and the number of people affected are much higher.
It's much higher. Charlie Hebdo was, over 3 days, around 22. This is 60, the news programs are saying. It's hard to even get your mind around it. I'm going out soon, but there's no taxis to be had. I don't even, every neighborhood is in lockdown. The streets in my neighborhood are quiet. I'm very far from where this is taking place.
Right. So the stadium is north of the city for people who know Paris at all.
Exactly. It's in the suburbs, right outside the city, a major stadium. France was playing Germany in a friendly game and, blasts went off. People started fleeing. And at one point, all the people went to the grass in the stadium. The news programs were showing people lying down on the grass in the soccer stadium. It was just like you've never seen such images.
So we're also hearing that there are as many as 100 and maybe it's even higher hostages being held. Where are those hostages
right.
been taken?
Yeah, this is a concert hall called the Bataclan. It's in a popular, great neighborhood where people go out. It's just a Friday night concert, and that's where that's going on. There's no newscasts have had teams down there, but we've gotten videos from, people from their cell phones and witnesses on site, and they're talking about police, elite units storming the Bataclan. There's a hostage situation going on, people coming out with blood on them. I mean, it's complete chaos. Nobody has the exact numbers. Nobody knows. No one's been caught yet. Paris is completely under attack, and everyone feels vulnerable right now, I can tell you that.
Well, and certainly it's very early in the situation, and it's still unfolding, but have there been any claims of responsibility, or is the government saying anything?
I haven't heard anything. The government, Hollande is supposed to speak momentarily. I'm waiting to listen to him speak. We've heard no claims of responsibility at all so far.
And so you said that Paris is basically in a lockdown. How are they actually putting that into place?
Well, I'm just getting, the police are telling people not to come out, and people are not coming out. I've just spoken to a friend of mine who lives near where some of this is going on, and she says many people from the streets have actually come into her apartment. They're scared to go home. So I think, and I've seen the newscast, the French news is out, and they're showing the streets that are completely empty and very, very lively neighborhoods on a Friday night. The streets are empty right now.
So as far as you know, is the actual attack or that first coordinated attack over, or is it still an active shooting situation?
In fact, nothing is over. In fact, Hollande has just declared that France is in a state of emergency. The country is in a complete state of emergency. Nothing has been concluded. I'm just seeing this on the news flashes. They're closing the borders. Everyone is being mobilized. The military is being reinforced. France is in a state of complete emergency.
And has the stadium been completely evacuated? I can only imagine.
No, not at all.
Because in the chaos of it, too, there's also the danger of, I'm sure, people getting trampled trying to get out.
No, I think it's not that crowded, but it's bigger than that. That's one place. There's other places. There's rumors now of other places. It's complete chaos. And that's all I can say right now is just absolute chaos here, and no one knows what's going on. And the country, the entire country, is in a state of emergency.
And there are no reports from other regions of similar attacks?
Not yet. But Olan has said a state of emergency on all the territory. So it's really big. It's as much big. This is Charlie Hebdo tenfold.
Well, Eleanor, I know that there's only so much that you know right now, but what do you expect Olan to say? And the French psychology and mindset was so rocked by the Charlie Hebdo attacks. What impact is this going to have?
I think that people are going to be really destabilized, completely emotionally wrecked, because France has been under high security protection since Charlie Hebdo. There's soldiers everywhere, and yet this still happened. So this means that we really can't prevent it.
Right.
That's what it means.
Right. Certainly, earlier in the year, there was a much more visible police presence on the streets in Paris, and I can only imagine it makes people feel that much more vulnerable if this can happen despite all that.
Absolutely, they do. And on that note, I'm going to let you go because I'm going to try to go out myself and see what's going on.
Okay, well, take care, Eleanor. Be safe, and we'll look forward to your reports.
Thank you so much.
That was Eleanor Beardsley. She is NPR's correspondent in Paris. She was updating us on the situation still unfolding in Paris, coordinated attacks that occurred at the stadium, the National Stadium just north of Paris. Also in entertainment venues, there are dozens dead. Also hostages, as many as 100. The update that we have is that President François Hollande has closed the French borders at this point. Eleanor Beardsley said that the city is also under lockdown. Police are asking all residents of Paris and the Île-de-France region to stay indoors. President Barack Obama has announced that this is not just an attack on Paris or the people of France, but on the values we all share. We will certainly be keeping up on this evolving situation through reports from NPR News.
Coming up at 8 o'clock tonight, you can join us for As It Happens, more coverage of the situation in Paris from CBC Radio. We'll be hearing news and interviews from around the world on As It Happens. And, of course, stay tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio. We'll keep you updated on the situation there as well. You're listening to Central Time.